same time at the end of 1 Samuel, where Saul goes off and he has a battle with the Philistine kings, and David's pursuing the Amalekites. And it's such a juxtaposition because you see Saul's descent. He visits the witch of Endor. Instead of consulting the Lord, he consults a medium, something that he should not have been doing. He is so far off base at this point, it isn't funny. And true to form, he goes to war and he loses. David, now God's anointed, he pursues the Amalekites who performed a horrible raid and just excessive brutality and destroyed David's camp and stole his women, his wives, his children, that of his compatriots, and they hunted those Amalekites down and they destroyed them, or at least most of them. Because what happens now is that an Amalekite comes and tells David that Saul is dead. This is his first report. This is his first hearing of this. And he says to him, well, how do you know? He says, well, and this is where the story gets interesting. He says, I was walking along, minding my own business, fleeing from a POW camp, and oh, I just happened upon him. Geographically, this is a bit of a, huh? Doesn't make sense, but okay. So maybe you were. Maybe you took this massive circuitous route, and you stumbled upon him. But what does that Amalekite tell David? What does he tell him? He says, I came across Saul and he was still alive. But what was he leaning on? What had impaled him? According to the Amalekite, Saul was leaning on his spear. But in 1 Samuel 31, what did Saul impale himself with? Anybody remember? His sword. And you know, that story is consistent with the death of Saul as it's recorded in 1 Chronicles chapter 10. Saul impales himself on his sword, not his spear. And so there's a little hint to us, the reader, because David's completely ignorant of the situation, right? But there's this hint to us as the reader, maybe the Amalekite isn't necessarily telling the truth. Regardless, he takes it upon himself to finish off Saul, kill him dead, and then he pulls his crown off. Another curiosity. Maybe he is wearing the crown, not a helmet. Maybe he's wearing his crown. Sure, we'll give him that. And an armlet off his arm. And he decides to bring these things to David. And what we're led to believe in this story is he thinks he's doing something good. He thinks he's coming, he's bringing good news. And for us as the reader, we've been tracking along. But there's this massive difference between us as the reader, especially in the 21st century, and what David is experiencing as he's hearing this firsthand. But David's heartbroken. But if we've been tracking and studying the scriptures carefully and listening faithfully to the word of God, there's certain things about Saul's death that are just kind of, well, they're just blunt truths. Saul's death was just. It was the result of his failure to obey. And the ironies of this event are not lost on the reader. Saul had lost his kingship because he refused to obey God about destroying all of the Amalekites. Do you remember that back in chapter 15, 1 Samuel 15? But now you've got this Amalekite that Saul had failed to eliminate. And this is who ends up killing him. And here's the great curiosity, the great irony, the great moment. The Amalekite obeys Saul and kills him. Saul doesn't obey the Lord and lets the Amalekites live. And now, at the command of Saul, an Amalekite kills him. Kind of an interesting little switchback, isn't it? Saul's death was just. It was God's justice. Saul's death was necessary. It was pretty clear that he wasn't giving up the crown. It had to be taken away from Saul because he wasn't giving it up voluntarily. But it's interesting that David doesn't take the crown off his head. The Amalekite does. And we're supposed to hear that. We're supposed to hear that story. David did not kill Saul. He did not kill Saul. This was not a mutiny. It was not a rebellion. David didn't do it. And we're supposed to know that. But it was necessary because David, in order to become king, Saul had to not be king because that's just the way it was. His death was predictable. You see, throughout 1 Samuel, the comparison of David's ascent and Saul's decline. And it's tragic. It's absolutely tragic. We're talking about the king of Israel, the king of the Hebrews. And think about how, like, think about what he goes through. This is almost Rasputin-esque, his death. He gets shot with arrows. He gets perforated like a Tetley teabag. He gets filled with arrows. He falls on his sword. And then he gets finished off by a nobody. And then later the Philistines come along and decapitate him and take his body and impale it on a wall. Utter shame. Utter degradation. It's tragic. It's sad. But you know what's really unusual about all of this is David's reaction. Because Saul was out hunting him. Saul wanted to kill him. Saul trekked over all of Tarnation to find him and kill him. And David eludes him. David has two opportunities to kill Saul, doesn't do it. I mean, David's released. He's free. Nobody's hunting him anymore. His arch nemesis, this man, this mad king who's trying to kill him, is dead. Don't you think that there'd be some sense of relief? Possibly even joy? Yes. Don't we triumph over our foes when we defeat them? Shouldn't he be celebrating? Shouldn't there be a victory cry? Shouldn't there be a, woo! The king is dead. Long live the king. Or in the words of the Munchkins, ding dong, the witch is dead. The king is dead. The king is dead. None of that. None of that. What you get is mourning and weeping and fasting. And I want to know why. I want to know why. And then I thought about that. And I thought long and hard about that. And just out of curiosity, I probably don't need a show of hands. How many of you have been hunted by a king in the last 10, 20 years? Any of you had to flee for your lives because somebody wanted to kill you? If that's true, don't put up your hand. Most of us can't relate. But all of us, just about all of us, maybe not all of us, but just about all of us, have probably felt at some time, like someone wasn't looking out for our best interest. Maybe at times we may have even felt persecuted. Maybe there was somebody who just wanted to wield evil. And how do you respond to that? How do you respond to a person that does that? And I want to know, like, what are the insights that we can pull out of this? Because after we get through that narrative section, 1 to 16, 17 to 27, is this incredible poem that David composes on the spot. Do you have your Bibles with you? Can you flip open to that? We read this. If you're using the blue Bibles, it's page 300. 300. For 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 17, David took up a lament concerning Saul and his son Jonathan, and he ordered that the people of Judah be taught this lament of how it is written in the book of Yashar. This is what he writes. A gazelle lies slain on your heights, Israel. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. These are Philistine cities. Lest the daughters of the Philistines be glad. Lest the daughters of the uncircumcised rejoice. Mountains of Gilboa, may you have neither dew nor rain nor showers fall on your terraced fields. For there the shield of the mighty was despised, the shield of Saul no longer rubbed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the flesh of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back. The sword of Saul did not return unsatisfied. Saul and Jonathan, in life they were loved and admired, and in death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery, who adorned your garments with ornaments of gold. How the mighty have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies slain on your heights. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother, for you were very dear to me, for your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. How the mighty have fallen, the weapons of war have perished. This is his response. This is how David reacts to the death of one who persecuted him and to his surrogate brother, Jonathan. And I wonder to myself, like, what kind of lessons can we learn from this? How do we bless those who persecute us? I mean, that was the passage that Russ read for us, that famous passage, Romans 12, bless those who persecute you. How do we do that? Because it's easy to kick that out, right? Bless those who persecute. Okay, how do I do that? How do I bless somebody who persecutes me? And the first point I'd like to make this morning is simply this. Resist the temptation to celebrate when they fall. If you look at verses 19 and 27, they form something that they call an inclusio. It's like bookends to a portion. You even actually have a reiteration of that in verse 25. But it's the phrase, the mighty have fallen. The mighty have fallen. In verse 19 in the NIV, it says the gazelle. Other translations would say your glory or your beauty. And you're thinking, how do you get from gazelle to glory? It's actually the same word in Hebrew. It's like lead, led, and led, right? L-E-A-D, lead. Or someone was led, L-E-D. Or that bullet was made out of lead, L-E-A-D. Same thing happens in all languages, and it happens in Hebrew. It's the same word. And it's just kind of like a little play on words, because you would expect to find a gazelle up the mountain, but you also see the glory of the Lord on the mountain. And here, this is where Saul and Jonathan have died, and something beautiful and graceful and elegant and wonderful is dead, and the glory of God now tarnished in David's mind. What we're supposed to understand is, in David's heart and his mind, something terrible has happened. And he refuses to gloat or celebrate. I think all of you know by now my joy of the great sport of football. And it doesn't really matter what sport you're talking about, but football, it's just so, so obvious. If they score a touchdown, there's like this incredible happy dance that ends in the end zone. And it's become more and more sophisticated. Lately, they've been reenacting dance scenes from various Disney movies, and it's just elaborate, and the crazy things they do to celebrate. And that's all well and good and fun. The NFL actually put an end to that for a little while. They didn't want those celebrations, and people complained, and they said, okay, celebrations, but there's some caveats. Because there's also a penalty that you can get called taunting. And that's when you're celebrating in an inappropriate way. But, you know, if you've ever played football, if you've had a child that's played football, if you ever watched football, you know that sometimes when person A knocks down a member of team B, sometimes they stand over them and say some things. They stand over them and say a very adult version of na-na-na-na-na, and then out comes the penalty flag. Unsportsmanlike conduct. Taunting. How many of you are old? How many of you are old enough to remember when Dave Tiger Williams got traded to the Vancouver Canucks? Do you remember Tiger Williams' famous celebration when he was with the Canucks, where he rode his hockey stick like a broomstick down center ice after scoring a goal? You know, we score, we win, we have some sort of celebration. David's not celebrating. He's not gloating. He's not going, yeah! He's not. And I think that's really a key point, that when your enemy falls, and they will fall, don't gloat, don't celebrate. You think about Obadiah's warning to Edom, chapter 1, verse 12, but do not gloat over the day of your brother in the day of his misfortune. Do not rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their ruin. Do not boast in the day of their distress. Edom were the sons of Esau. And Esau, of course, was at odds with Jacob and Israel's Jacob's family. And they go into exile. They're defeated. They're destroyed. And the temptation for Edom is to go, yeah, celebrate. Let's go get their stuff. God says, don't do it. Do not do that. And why not? Because of what it says in verse 15. For the day of the Lord is near upon all the nations. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deeds shall return to your own head. You think of that verse that Russ read for us, verse 19. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Or rather, think of Proverbs 24, verses 17 and 18. Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your hearts be glad when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it and be displeased and turn away his anger from him. Friends, the wrath of God is a terrible and terrifying thing. And when we really understand what awaits those who are enemies of God, how can we feel anything but compassion and pity? When you look at that person who's been persecuting you, and you hear them cursing the Lord, and you realize that their eternity is hell, that their fate is damnation, that they will spend eternity separated from God, how can you feel anything but sad? Because eternity is a very long time. How can we feel anything but compassion and pity? So resist the temptation to gloat and do your best to show them some respect. Saul was king. Saul was God's anointed. You look at verse 21, shield, king, anointed with oil. These are all connected ideas. And when it talks about the shield in that poem, he's talking about the king. And the shield is rubbed with oil, but the king has been anointed. Yet David did not mention Saul's death directly. Instead, he refers to a desecration of the anointed, the shield of the mighty ones. And he does this on purpose. The term is relatively ambiguous, since it can mean a benevolent being or defensive weaponry, but he really wants us to see this connection. There's this poetic play on words. Saul and his sons were Hebrew royalty. That's not something to be taken lightly. That's not something to just blow off. That's not like, oh, well, who cares? Which is progressively more difficult in this day and age, where respect seems to be, you know, a diminished commodity, sometimes very, very hard to find, where people don't respect even the office. I mean, even if you don't care for the person, even if you don't care for the politician, the fact of the matter is, this is a member of parliament. This is potentially the leader of a political party. This could be the prime minister of your country, the president of somebody else's, the king of another. Even if you don't think the world of so-and-so, do you ever stop to realize that all we know about so-and-so is what the media tells us about so-and-so? Because you've never actually met so-and-so? You don't know anything about them firsthand. All you know is what you've heard. All you know is what you've seen, what you've read. And that really comes down to the person telling you that story and what they want you to know. And so they tell the story from their perspective. I mean, I haven't seen as many sunrises or sunsets as some of you, but I've seen a few more than others. And I can tell you this. I can tell you this about old Pastor Norm. Hey, brother, what do you think of Pastor Norm? Oh, Pastor Norm, he's amazing. He is ridiculously handsome and just abundantly intelligent, and he's kind and gracious, and I just love him, the sweetest man in the world. You might turn to somebody else and say, sister Gabriella, what do you think of Pastor Norm? he snores, and he smells bad, and he eats voraciously. He makes noises while he eats, and he complains incessantly. He's never happy, and all he does is sit in a chair and watch sports. I married him, but... Now I make jest because everybody knows that you are madly in love with me. But you know what? Both of those things are, to greater or lesser degrees, true. And you're talking about the same person. You know, when we talk about other people, especially our foes when they're defeated, show them some respect. The Amalekite, verse 14, David said to him, "How is it that you are not afraid to put your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Biblical scholar says this. He says, "The narrative account not only provides interesting historical data, but also clears David of any suspicions that may have been aroused by his possession of Saul's jewelry. David acquired them not by participating in the battle against Saul, but by executing Saul's killer." And there's the difference. This Amalekite, this enemy of Israel, he's not afraid to strike God's anointed. But God's anointed is afraid to strike God's anointed. Wouldn't dare do it. Would not dare do it. And at the risk of sounding self-serving and in humility over the fact that I have been guilty of this in the past, be careful how you talk about your pastor. Because once upon a time, y'all sat in this room and you voted to make me your pastor. And about 14 years ago, there was a whole group of colleagues of mine that agreed that I was ordained to God's ministry. I'm not perfect. I don't claim to be perfect. But if I am ordained by God, anointed by God to be the pastor of this church, be careful. Be careful about striking out against the leadership of the church, which you elected. Be careful. Every church I've been part of has had the same problem. Whether as a pastor or as a congregant, it's something that we're notorious for in our evangelical traditions. Be careful. I think one of the greatest blessings of the holiday was when we were at that little Lutheran church, and I said to somebody at the church, I said, "Your pastor's fantastic." And he is, he was. He preached an amazing message, young guy. Brilliant message. On par with Dr. Shepherd. I mean, he was brilliant. And you know what this person said to me? "We just love our pastor. We just love our pastor." And I thought, that's good. That's good. Be careful about striking God's anointed, because God has a way of dealing with people who do that. Look at verse 17, Romans 12, 17. "Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to what is honorable in the sight of all men." And you know, picking up on what Keith was sharing in Psalm 1, the very first verse, "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, or stands in the way of sinners, or sits in the seat of scoffers," walking, standing, sitting. Don't do it in, with, amongst, in the presence of scoffers, English Standard Version. Mockers, New International Version. Scornful, the King James Version. I promise you, in a room this size, there are those of you who think that I'm right, and there are those of you who think I'm wrong. And there's ways of communicating that. There's ways of dealing with that. Do it in an honorable way. Do it in an honorable way. Do it in an honorable way. David was brokenhearted, not just because of loyalty and respect, but because he loved Saul and Jonathan. And we can bless those who persecute us by refusing to hate. David did not speak ill of the dead, but instead he venerates them. 2 Sam 1, verse 23, Saul and Jonathan refers to them as beloved and lovely. He tells the daughters of Israel to weep over Saul in verse 24. He says, "I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary. surpassing the love of women, verse 26. Another biblical scholar makes this point. He says, a man's wife was his partner in procreation and parenting, but not necessarily his best friend or confidant or social peer. For David, Jonathan was the peer, friend, and confidant that no wife could ever have been in that society. And his untimely death left a gaping hole in David's soul. You know who else refused to hate? You know who else absolutely refused to hate? Jesus. And how do we know that? Because he was nailed to a cross. And of the people who nailed him to the cross, he hung there between heaven and earth. And you know what he says? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. That's Jesus. That's our example. Look at Romans 12 again, verses 14 and verse 21. Bless those who persecute, bless and do not curse them. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So how do we overcome the anger that turns to hatred? Give me that next slide there, Wayne. Here's a few thoughts. How do we overcome the anger that turns to hatred? Well, practice empathy and understanding. A book I read last year was called What Happened to You? So often we're prone to asking the question, what a jerk, what's wrong with him? What's the matter with you? What's the matter with you? Instead of asking, what's the matter with you? Ask the question, brother, what happened to you? What happened? You know, as we learned yesterday, you know, behavior is a form of communication. We had this great training session. Those of us who work with the food bank and a few others had this great training session with Vanessa Tachuk. And she works with the Salvation Army and she deals with street people and homeless people. And, you know, she talked about having empathy, but having compassion for people. When people are acting badly, sometimes the question isn't so much, what's wrong with you? What's the matter with you? Maybe the question is, what happened to you? Because so often aberrant behavior is a reflection of a crisis that somebody endured. Something happened in that person's life to make them act that way. Practice forgiveness, and that's something we've talked about a lot. And again, I would refer you to Lewis Smead's book, The Art of Forgiving. Here's a point that came up abundantly yesterday too. Try not to take things personally. When somebody's behaving badly, maybe it has absolutely nothing to do with you. Maybe it's got everything to do with them. But rather, let us practice the imitation of Christ. That, too, is a famous book written by Thomas A. Kempis hundreds of years ago. But I think ultimately when people persecute us, we remember the words of Christ, that we are to expect persecution and opposition. And the appropriate response is to rejoice. Matthew 5:11, blessed are you. Blessed are you when others revile you, and persecute you, and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Overcome evil with good. Don't let anger turn into hatred. You know, we visit or revisit the idea of Saul's death, and we understand that it was just, that it was necessary, that it was predictable, and it was tragic. But you know what was unusual is David's reaction. David didn't celebrate. He sang, but it was a dirge. David revered Saul because Saul had been the anointed ruler of Israel. David accentuated the good in Saul and reiterated his love for Jonathan. I've actually had people say this to me about funerals. It's like, well, why doesn't anybody tell the whole story? I said, judicious editing. We're there to remember the good. We're there to celebrate a life. We're there to focus on the good things in that person. And everybody has a little good, everybody has a little bad. But today we're going to focus on the good things. Today we're going to focus on the good things. Every once in a while I hear people say, I don't want a funeral. I usually don't say much, but you know what goes on in my head? Funeral ain't for you. You're dead. Funeral's for your family. They need that. They need that closure. They need to be able to say goodbye. I had somebody once say to me, "My funeral, I don't want anybody to say anything good." My reaction was, "No problem." That's bad, right? Not the right thing to think. But when he dies, we will. Whether he wants us to or not, we're going to say some good things about him. Because that's what you do. You remember the good. You forget the bad. Because if all you do is remember the bad, you know whose soul gets poisoned? Yours. The only person you hurt is you. Judicious editing. We will be persecuted. And friends, our enemies will fall. When that happens, don't gloat. Show respect and refuse to give in to hate. I think in this way we will honor and glorify God by blessing those who persecute us. Amen. Keith, come and lead us in our closing song, would you, brother?